today, this would be a very taboo Me Too.
Well, yeah, it's a good thing that you didn't meet in 2018.
It would never have happened. That's like the alternate timeline where we basically meet this. It you know, then eventually there's like a lawsuit or something like that. Somebody gets canceled. Maybe multiple people get canceled. She looks at me and she's like, Roger? And I just like reflexively respond without even making the connection that she might be talking about my co-founder. Say, I could be Roger.
That's TMI.
No, it's not. It's like, this is a relationship podcast.
We need to get in the weeds here.
I mean, people need to know what to do.
Wait, you proposed?
Yeah, what? Yeah. You're kind of shortcutting to the answer for those of our listeners who want to know how to unlock, you know, true happiness. Propose on the first meeting.
Today on Modern Relationships, I sit down with Adam Grease and Ria Yano, two serial entrepreneurs who've been married over a decade. What started as a misunderstanding, Ria thought she was pitching her startup to an investor, while Adam was secretly hoping for a date, has evolved into one of the most intentional partnerships I've encountered. They share why great relationships shouldn't feel like work, how they maintain a truly equal 50-50 partnership while raising two kids and building companies, and why finding the right partner might involve challenging probability and really getting out there. Adam and Ray, thank you for coming on the podcast. I've wanted to have you for a long time. You guys are an admirable couple, been together for over a decade, have two amazing children, have an incredible life together. Thank you guys for coming on.
Thanks for having us.
It's a real pleasure.
So I want to start with a very big question that you guys think have thought a lot about. How do you know when you found the one, and do you believe in even a concept of the one?
So I've always been of the mind that when things work, they are just effortless. And so that guided a lot of my choices with partners. And at some point, you know, I'd had enough relationships where I had made some compromises and been together with somebody long enough to understand what the lines are of what I was willing to compromise on and what not. And so I had a better kind of layout so that I can combine that feeling of, hey, it's effortless, which is quite rare in itself, with a more systematic evaluation of, okay, how do I probe the limits of what might be ideal in terms of fit, and then quickly come to a conclusion. And so I'd say, you know, a lot of it was intuitive. And in my case with Ria, like when I met her, I felt like, oh, she could be a person who I'd want to be with indefinitely. But then very quickly afterward, there was a kind of validation step.
And you met her by basically pretending that you were interested in investing in her company, right? And then she pitched you, and then you know, immediately shifted the conversation to romantic context. Is that accurate?
Where'd you get that? Snopes? 4chan? I mean, there is that urban legend. The reality was a little bit different.
But yeah, so I was starting my company and I never had fundraised before. So I reached out to a friend in New York who had raised money from VCs, and I was asking her for intros to investors and, you know, successful entrepreneurs who may angel invest. And so
meanwhile, yeah. I was in SF and I went to a 500 startups demo day where this now mutual friend of ours was presenting. And we, you know, talked a little bit afterwards. I thought her company was interesting. And so we just met up casually. And after that, she was living in New York and I was in SF, but I remembered, oh yeah, this entrepreneur was pretty cool. Maybe I'll check if she has any cute single friends. She was dating somebody at the time. And so I reached out to her and I was like, hey, my buddy and I are coming to New York. Do you have any cute single friends we could hang out with? And she was like, yes, I do. Well, she didn't pitch it that way to me.
I thought I was going for an elevator pitch. I literally practiced my 30-second pitch of my company at the time. But it was a Monday night, 10 p.m. meeting in Chelsea.
At a bar restaurant, right? So that was the context. And, you know, when she asked our mutual friend was like, oh, yeah, there are these two founders. I think the angel invest, you know, why don't you come out? And so I think Rhea was thinking, yeah, that's how you do the business. This is it, yeah, you know?
Going to fundraise.
Yeah. Yeah. We didn't know that, of course. We were just naively going to meet some cute girls, quote unquote. But I mean, they were very cute. But
today, this would be a very taboo Me Too.
Well, yeah, it's a good thing that you didn't to meet in 2018.
Right. Back in those days.
I think that it would never have happened. That's like the alternate timeline where we basically meet it. It you know, then eventually, you know, there's like a lawsuit or something like that. But somebody gets canceled. Maybe multiple people get canceled. But anyway, so I walk into this kind of downstairs, which was a restaurant. Upstairs was this dance bar. And nobody's there. And then I walk in. My co-founder at the time, his name is Roger. And I walk in and there's this booth. And I see like there are a few people in the booth, right? But I don't see my friend. And I'd never seen Rhea before. And so I suddenly see Rhea as I come across kind of like the corner of the booth. And I'm like, wow, this girl is cute. And she looks at me and she's like, Roger? And I just like reflexively respond without even making the connection that you might be talking about my co-founder. Say, I could be Roger. And then I see my friend right as I take that next step. And I think from that point, it was kind of clear. All right, this is probably not a pitch.
But Bria, you were okay with it. What happened then?
Well, so it was immediately obvious that this was not what I expected. But what was surprising actually in that same evening was that Adam mentioned that he was married.
I proposed that same evening.
So I definitely didn't think he was the one that night. I just thought, who is this guy? Like,
wait, you proposed?
Yeah. Well, yeah. This is, by the way, I mean, you're kind of shortcutting to the answer for those of our listeners who want to know how to unlock, you know, true happiness. Propose on the first meeting. That is actually the secret. Basically, we met. She kind of, I would say, tricked me into it a little bit. You know, Rhea is very good at using different psychological ploys and doing it intuitively. So we're talking and I'm like, oh yeah, you know, I won the green card lottery and then I naturalized because I grew up in Israel and I'm a citizen. And then I'm like, and I studied abroad. I just naturalized like a year before. So this is a big deal for me. And I studied abroad in Japan at the same university. It so happens, we didn't know this, that she went to undergrad in, right? Yeah. And so then we're like, wow, that's amazing. And then she says, well, you know, I might have to go back to Japan because I'm an H-1B and they might like kick me out if it doesn't get renewed. And I mean, what could I say? You know, of course I said like, I'll marry you, right? I didn't have a choice, basically.
Yeah, she forced you to.
Pretty much. So, you know, and I think she was just thinking, oh, this guy will say anything to get in my pants.
And she was accurate?
I think I was, you know, I had been living in New York, so definitely jaded. And if anyone says they'll marry me on their first date, you'd think this is a crazy person. Yeah. So,
not anything. Yeah. You know what I mean?
I think it took time.
Let's say it was a wide range.
Yeah, it took a few days to understand who Adam is and consider it a serious relationship.
Tell the story of how it escalated from there in terms of turning into a serious relationship and like when you kind of both knew that, hey, this is the thing.
Well, you were only in town for like 2-3 days.
So. About 5 days, actually, we're left. Yeah. But so we basically had 3 dates. That first night, after we were chatting, we went to another bar and then everybody else peeled off and we just stayed till like 1 a.m. And that was our first date. So we made out that first night. But that was it.
That's TMI.
No, it's not. It's like, this is a relationship podcast.
We need to get in the weeds here.
I mean, people need to know what to do. I mean, like, what are the 3 big takeaways? Like, you know what I mean? There is somebody sitting on their couch right now who may be a little bit feeling inadequate or unsure. And they're wondering, was it wrong to kiss on the first date? You know, and they need to know that it's okay.
Yeah. I mean, they're even wondering, how did Adam do it? Like, what did he say? What was the move?
That guy looks like a fool. How? What was the secret? You know, maybe I can copy it.
Is he like really rich or something?
Right. Bingo. Right. So.
Well, so we went on another day.
That was the next day. And then I planned it really thoroughly. It was like almost 9-to-5 extravaganza.
Wow.
Everything was dialed in to the minute. You know, very uncharacteristically. You know, Rhea was very impressed. She's Japanese. She likes things dialed into the minute. And so basically we met in the morning, we went on a bike ride. So I thought I wanted to do a mix, kind of to do activities that would expose the kind of personalities and whether we met. And so we biked up to the Cloisters on the West Side Highway. Then we went back and we had a reservation to grab food at this nice restaurant and then a movie. And before we went to the restaurant, I thought she might want to shower because we were very sweaty.
Let's not talk.
What? Why not? Wait, which part?
Go ahead. We can edit this later, right?
Yeah, you have final edit, don't worry.
Well, we won't, right? But okay. Anyway, so I was like, do you want to shower? So we stopped by the place where I was staying. I was like, do you want to shower? She's like, I'm not showering at your place. I just met you, basically. It's a trick, right? But I was like, do you want to go shower at your place? And she was like, no, let's just go to the restaurant. And we're just like in our, you know, workout-ish clothes. And this is like a pretty nice restaurant. And I was like, all right, this is a good sign. You know what I mean? She doesn't care, you know?
About like hygiene and stuff like that.
About what other people think.
Right. Okay, so sort of flesh this out. Sort of you have this idea of what you're looking for in the one. You go on two dates with Rie. Then what?
Well, basically, so on the third day, you know, we went out to dinner. We had some like different candies and stuff like that. And yeah, I was just making an effort to woo her, you know?
So you were already sold.
I thought that it was a strong enough potential that I should really double down hard because I'd been in a relationship for a year and a half, which was not the right fit for me. And I was in a mode of finding somebody to commit to indefinitely. And so my attitude was, imagine that you have committed to this person when you get into the relationship and don't hold anything back because assume that you're going to be in it for 50 years. Just imagine you're going to be in it with somebody for 50 years. You want to just like address everything as soon as you can, whatever the things are. And so, yeah, I took it pretty, let's say, seriously, but not in a way that was like, you know, tension provoking or like, you know, made it dry, you know, just giving it the gravity of, hey, this could be really meaningful. And so I'm going to give it the appropriate level of attention.
Yeah. So I think on my end, he was definitely more meticulous. You know, he had a checklist. He had all these questions he was asking me. But I think for me, like, it became more serious after he went back to SF and I was in New York. And I thought, oh, this is just like a few days thing. And he's going to go back to his city and who knows what's going to happen. And it's keeping it open-minded. But then Adam was constantly asking to be co-locating.
She didn't even know. She didn't even know what I meant.
I was like, what do you mean? And he was like, oh, just keep your Skype on.
That was in Skype days. It was pre-Zoom.
Totally. Just like keep us, like, let's just keep it live throughout the day. And I kind of like.
I just want to get to know you better.
The weirdest thing ever. But he, like, every single day, we were co-locating on Skype. And he would just be like eating his avocado for lunch. His co-founder would like be walking back and forth and he'd be like chatting with 10 other people but he would be there and it was the weirdest thing. I've never had that. Like, no one does that.
I gotta say, yeah.
I think that felt like, okay, this is not, I don't, maybe this is something.
Because it was very clear. I tried to innovate, you know, with limited means. I was in SF and so I just thought like, okay, what's the maximum acceleration get to know this person better. I just thought, well, it's like, you know, hours, just like clock more hours, you know, that's how you do it. And so I was like, well, you could just be in my virtual office. We'll be office mates, you know, it'll be cool. And yeah, it was like, there were a lot of things that she got to see in my life, even though it was sometimes like awkward, right? Like you're eating in front of the computer. Yeah. And she was like, I don't want you seeing like some spinach stuck between my, like, this is not contributing to enhancing our relationship. right now.
Were you ever like concerned about you know, Adam's intensity, or were you sold from the beginning, or what was your sort of process?
I guess it was more like curiosity. Like everything was like different. But then I thought it made sense for Adam to do this because I actually saw that he records everything and he had a file where he keeps track and records every single conversation he has with other people. Right? Like you used to have that.
Well, I mean, not written. I would just like record all my Skype conversations.
All of his conversations. And so he's super OCD about it. So I thought, okay, in his world, this is pretty normal. And my world is really weird. But, you know, hey, maybe...
Maybe I can get an investment. Maybe I'll finally come through. No, just kidding. You're just kidding. You're going to pop a question. How much can I put in?
I give up on the angel investment or any of that. But that...
You know that recording calls is illegal in California, right?
Well, actually, it depends on the state. As long as there are some states where as long as one party is informed, that's allowed.
Okay.
Anywho, yeah. So, you know, it's funny because, yeah, a lot of things were happening in the background. I think it's an undervalued way of getting to know people, you know, like my co-founders were walking around, all sorts of people were walking around. It's like, who was that person? Who is this person? Et cetera.
Yeah. And I think our next encounter was when I went to SF with my co-founder. So we were interviewing for YC and we didn't have that much cash at that time. So I asked him if we can crash at his place. So my co-founder and I just kind of rolled in and lived out of Adam's apartment for a few days. And
that was October. So we met in June. So 4 months. So I hadn't seen her for 4 months. Then she comes to SF for basically like, I don't know, 5 days or something like that. And she's staying there with her co-founder. And at that point, you know, in our conversations, I had this feeling that of fear. And it was the first time I experienced this with a partner. And the fear was that she understood me so well that I would have the thought like, oh, maybe she wouldn't like this, or she wouldn't like that behavior. And I would be like catching myself and thinking, if I'm thinking that, she must know that I'm thinking that. So it was like a positive fear.
So a few months in, you're basically sold, hooked.
Well, basically I went to New York for a week to kind of scope it out because my co-founder at the time and I were like whining about like women in San Francisco and let's find a wife in New York. And New York is so fun. And I went back to SF and I was like, you know, I like SF better. So it's like 60-40. I want to stay in SF because my heart is, you know, with maximum acceleration. And so then she and I went on a walk down Legion of Honor in SF. And then she, you know, kind of manipulated me to move to New York. Do you remember? So basically, we're walking down there and she's like, she used reverse psychology. So she was like, this isn't going to work. You know, you're not going to move to New York. And I was just like, yes, I am. I'll show you. I'm going to move to New York. I'm going to buy my ticket today to New York. And I'm going to move in with you in New York. And so later that day, I bought my ticket for December 2nd. And 6 weeks after that, I moved in.
And then you guys were official.
Well, I think we were still testing it out. It's like, why not live together? And I think Adam kept his house in SF and it was my apartment he moved into. So if anything went, you know, sour, we hadn't fully committed. Like he could leave, we'd be fine.
Did you guys have, you said, you know, when it's the one, it's not effortful. Was your sort of courting process like pretty smooth sailing together? Like, did you just get steadily, you know, progressive, more confidence for both of you? Or were there yellow flags? Or were you unsure at some point?
No.
No, it was progressive or increasing confidence, basically.
Okay, so zooming out, what do you think other people can learn? Or what do you advise people when it comes to picking a partner and then the sort of, you know, courting or dating process itself?
I mean, look, we're biased, right? because we have our own experience. I want to say work is for fools. A lot of people say, work on it. It's like, no, don't work on it. Find somebody where it doesn't feel like work or it doesn't require that much work. Now, I'm not saying that like there aren't things where you can be deliberate about improving the relationship in different ways, et cetera. But if it feels like work at the very beginning, and if it feels like a lot of work in different at different points, I think in most cases, it's just not the right fit. You know what I mean? People struggle, and that's because they don't know better. And there are all sorts of reasons where they get kind of pulled in, and it's hard for them to get out, so they justify the hard work. But I will say one caveat to that, and then hand it off to Rie, which is that it's all about knowing yourself. Like, we've seen a lot of people over the years, friends of ours, got married, got divorced. Sometimes we knew they would get divorced, where it's like, you know, you're already planning for the divorce when you're at the wedding and, you know, for the recovery of your friend. Is it? I mean, it's just a matter of fact. But I don't know. I mean, I think our predictions have been pretty spot on so far. I mean, at least like five or so people were in that bucket. But anyway, I think that like some people do need to work at it. So my point is that in my mental model, if it's true that like every pot has its cover kind of situation, some pots are just like, they need WD-40. There's the WD-40. There's nothing you can do about it. They rust easily. And so it's about knowing oneself. Some people are just like more anxious and they need to do some work in any relationship to bring it to a point where they're really super happy. Some people are really like commitment averse for whatever like history they had or whatever, and they need to do some work on that. So I don't deny that like for some people work is needed, but in our case it wasn't needed. And I think in many cases people confabulate that work is a necessity when it's just them not willing to move onwards and take the risk of finding somebody else.
I don't think I have any advice about any additional advice, but I would say the more common thing we do see is when things are not going right, but you still hold on to that relationship when you could just end it and move on. You think Adam and I are very similar in that it's pretty black and white for us when it, with relationships with ourselves too. Somebody's a yes or no in our circle. And we just wish that our friends would follow their kind of intuition and concerns and address it sooner so that they can open up more time to find their next match. And when we see that, you know, it drags on for years sometimes, and it's like time is so precious, you know, and you could be meeting so many exciting people. So it's almost like the lost opportunities is the area that like can be improved, I guess.
For sure.
Yeah.
We'll get right back to the conversation after a word from our sponsors. Modern Relationships is sponsored by Relationship Hero, your personal relationship coach. It's an open secret in Silicon Valley that people are using these relationship coaches. Over 100,000 users are happy they tried Relationship Hero. You might be wondering, what is it like to talk to a relationship coach? Well, here's Jackie Pugh, a senior coach at Relationship Hero.
That's a really good question. Okay, I actually just got off a call with a client who was getting mixed signals from his ex. So she's the one that broke up with him, but then she kept sending him these really heartfelt, long, emotional messages at midnight, and then in the morning would act like nothing ever happened.
We've all been there. How do you recommend handling something like that?
So what we would do is we would want to hear exactly what's going on so we can help discern, is my client's ex, is she just trying to process her emotions and she's doing it via text message? Is she potentially trying to keep my client on the back burner? Or is she actually trying to reconnect? And if she is, then I help my client decide, you know, is this something that he actually wants to do, reconnect? And if so, why?
Thanks, Jackie. If you want to try your first one-on-one or couples coaching session, go to relationshiphero.com/modern. You'll get $50 off your first session if you use our link. Again, that's relationshiphero.com/modern.
It's interesting because this is the opposite of the advice that a lot of people will say, which is, and even people in great relationships too, which is, hey, you know, because there's a lot of great people out there, but, you know, nothing is perfect And there are sort of different trade-offs with any great person, and, you know, relationships, especially ones that last a long time, are going to have their tough moments. And so stop being too quick to leave just because of one hard thing or something. Like, it feels like the advice is usually on the other side. Don't you feel like you hear that?
Definitely.
Yeah. Work hard. Like, marriages only work because you work hard. Right.
I mean, it just sounds like, I think for us, that just is not, you know, what the distribution looks like. I mean, I think we more lean towards the notion that, like, hey, if you can say about yourself, I feel like the luckiest person in the world to be with my partner. I feel so lucky and so grateful. Then to you, they're perfect. You know, they're as close to perfect as you're going to get. So this notion of, like, nobody's perfect, even though, yeah, it's true. We all have failures and faults, and we aren't perfect, but in some ways, in some deep way, we feel we're perfect for one another. You know what I mean? Or very close to that, where there isn't that doubt. And I feel like when that doubt is very present, it's often not the right fit.
And so is the number one mistake your friends have made when picking a partner that they just pick too quickly or something, or just sort of settle? Or what is their most mistake?
Good question.
I don't think mistakes.
I mean, I would say compromise. So it's not really about the picking necessarily too quickly. It's about being in a relationship with somebody where you have some signs that it's not a great fit, and yet you tell yourself a story which justifies a compromise for all sorts of reasons. Now, that doesn't mean they weren't dating a bunch of people before, but they somehow kind of end up stuck in this situation. And I intentionally say stuck because I feel like if their better natures were in control, they might break it off. You know what I mean?
You mentioned, you know, you alluded to, you know, being around a number of people with divorces. You know, you guys are quite old now.
Yeah. I mean, ancient, really. Some of these friends, we don't even remember their names anymore. Who were these people who so-called got married or divorced? It is hazy.
What's the craziest story you have about friends and their relationships?
I mean, I can tell one story that I've held on to for a long time, which is that a buddy of mine, one of my best friends growing up, he had this, like, very bad breakup. Long story, some issues there, and infidelity. And he started dating somebody. And I just thought, that person that he was dating was not great for him, that he could do better. You know what I mean? On a few different levels. And then they decided to get married. And I asked him, like, look, you know, I don't think she's at your level. Like, I think you could do better. And he said, yeah, but she'll never leave me. And then on the eve of the wedding, remember, I grew up with this guy, right? His two sisters stage an intervention, reach out to me, and they call me and they say, we think he shouldn't marry this person. And you, his best friend, need to tell him that because we don't want to harm our relationship with him. Can you believe that? And me, playing Jesus, basically, on the cross here, go to him and tell him, I hate to be the bearer of bad news, but I've thought about it, and you have to cancel the wedding. Without explaining why. You cannot marry this person.
Is that
like, yeah, I did say that. I did it because, you know, they came to me, and I was just like, I did what I needed to do. You know what I mean? To help them. Yeah, we're like family, right? And he's like, no, I'm going to marry her anyway. All right. So I'm like, listen. She'll never leave you, yada, yada, yada. And then, you know, I told him, well, you know, at least don't have kids before you, like, fulfill your ambition so you don't get, like, you know, bogged down, et cetera. And then, like, 6 months later, he calls me to say they're pregnant. And then I was like, I responded not enthusiastically. I didn't say something negative, but not enthusiastically. And then we didn't talk for 10 years.
Wow. So he could sort of sense that the disapproval?
Yeah.
Is there anything you would have done differently?
You know, the irony of that story is that they're still happily married.
Wow.
You know,
so you shouldn't follow our advice at all.
So, you know what I'm saying? That's the irony, right? It's kids are happy. I mean, who knows? You know what I'm saying? Maybe we don't know everything that's going on. But I think that, you know, that kind of is part of the, is one of the experiences that informs this idea that people are different. And some people do need to work at it. Some people do need a different something to feel whole. And so, yeah, but that was really pretty out there.
Yeah, it's fascinating.
Yeah, it's always interesting when to weigh in versus not to weigh in versus how to have so much confidence from the sidelines.
Totally.
What are some of the highest tension moments in your own relationship?
Yeah, so I mean, do you want to go first? Why don't you go first?
Yeah, I think the highest tension, so we don't really fight at all.
How do you not fight? Like, Adam isn't a very aggressive guy. It has about strong opinions.
Rhea's also pretty aggressive, just differently.
You know, it's interesting. I don't think I knew this. I mean, Adam always tells our friends that we're so similar. You know, I think, Eric, you've heard it too. Like, we're like one, we're like a presh. And I always think we're so different. You know, but then we pretty much agree to a lot of the most important aspects and values. I think that's probably why it doesn't result in a fight.
Well, what's a high tension moment?
Oh, the high tension moment, I would say, is when we were working together. Is that the first thing that came up for you?
No.
No?
I have a different story. So I'll let you tell your story.
Yeah. So for me, it was high tension because I had a startup that I ran for 10 years, an e-commerce business. And there was a critical moment in my business where our VP of engineering was going to leave. And Adam...
I was in between companies. I'd sold a company and I was just like, you know... A free agent.
Yeah. And Adam insisted on joining, you know, fully to help my company, given that the head engineering was leaving. And I felt that, you know, we're both entrepreneurs. You know, we met actually at the same time when we were raising. We just had started our own companies and was raising at the same time. So we were constantly working on our startups together, but never on the same thing. And so the tension that I felt was when it was just like 24/7 nonstop, the company. So you'd be working nonstop and you go to bed really exhausted and tired. And Adam would be, you know, next to me and I'm ready to go to sleep to like refresh and start a new day. And he would be like, hey, you know, I think we should do this about this company, you know? And even in bed, it was just like 24/7 startup, like intensity experience. And it just felt like it narrowed down the type of conversations we had with each other, that it wasn't as fun as a couple. And so that led to tension. I think we also have a different way of working. Adam likes to riff, talk. He's constantly talking and brainstorming and trying to figure out until the very last minute what is the best decision to make. And I'm a bit more structured. I like to have my private space and time to think before I share. And so, you know, working side by side on the same thing, I feel like we had moments where we just felt like we need to separate our tables and like separate our rooms at least so that it is manageable.
Well, but yeah, and you know, I think there is an aspect of this which is just like cross-cultural, because I'm Israeli and we as Japanese, even though we grew up to some degree in North America, we bring a lot of those cultures to the workplace, which is kind of interesting because in our private lives, I feel like we're both really super duper adaptable and the cultures are less impactful. But at work, if you can just think about some of the stereotypes, they come from true things, right? Like Israelis, improvise, casual, extremely direct, very non-hierarchical, Japanese, organized, meticulous, planning, precise. You know, those are superpowers, but they can also come into conflict. And so we definitely, I think, felt that. Yeah. Some tensions around that. There were people who cried, we cried, everybody cried, you know. But eventually, I think our work together, we ended up exiting that company. And I think it was a result of our collaborative effort. So it ended up kind of well, but it was definitely a high degree of pain. But I want to share a different source of tension for me, which is that one time I was sick and I was lying on the couch in our one bedroom in Hell's Kitchen. And we came home and I was just like, I'm sick. And she said, could I make you some lemonade? I said, yes, thank you so much. And so she makes the lemonade and she gives it to me. And then she like kind of saunters into the room, the bedroom, and she like lays on the bed to chill out, right? And I like drink the lemonade. And it is like the sourest lemonade. It's like there was not a drop of honey in that lemonade. It was basically lemon water. And so I was like, it's so sour, you know, from living room. And then she just like yells from the bedroom, deal with it. Like, why aren't you grateful for that lemonade? And I was like, it's not lemonade, it's a lemon juice. And yeah, that really, you know, it's been 10 years and it's hard for me to let that memory go. It was one of our biggest fights.
Yeah, we barely fight, but this comes up every time.
It's pretty funny. Rhea, are you just not someone who, like, did you get in fights with other people? Like, Adam is Israeli. It doesn't seem like he avoids fights or something.
Actually, no. I avoid fights.
Yeah, I think you're mild compared to many.
We're like zero drama.
Yeah.
People.
Yeah. We do surround ourselves with more zero drama types so that we don't have to.
We don't like to. You know, we don't like to. And we like, I think both of us actually are, even though we can be very assertive or even aggressive when necessary, we actually will, our bias is to avoid conflict, find a way to get to a beneficial outcome without it.
Although you shine the most when there's conflict. Like when there's like a crazy thing that happens, like Adam just glows and he starts getting creative. And that's different. I think I would feel more pressure or tension in moments of crazy conflict. And for you, it's just like, okay, let's solve it right now. You know, like I know how to solve this. And it's been, I'm trying to learn how to be.
Yeah, that's really interesting. How do you guys think about sort of divide and conquer in or roles in your relationship? One thing that seems pretty distinct is just sort of there's a strong sense of equality. Do you guys feel that? Or Rhea, how would you sort of describe that?
I think we're the only true 50-50 couple we know.
Some people will be offended to hear that, so I'm not going to weigh in.
Yeah, but I think, well, our circumstances make it that way too, and our personality. So, you know, we met when we were both starting our companies at the same time. So we understand, we're both, you know, serial entrepreneurs. We love working and building stuff, but we also have two kids. And we love being with our kids too. And so the way we split our responsibilities in the house as
and in general house,
and in general, like with every relationship we have, it's truly,
yeah, it's 50-50.
It is really 50-50.
And now if you think about it, like, what does that equality mean? It's that, you know, our life goals or our professional interests receive equal weight when we're deliberating how to allocate resources and time, how to support each other. It means that, like, in time spent with the kids, whether it's for pleasure or for responsibility, we really split it down the middle. And actually, you could say that with kids, it has become much more definitive because a lot more stuff has to be planned, right? If you're going to bring a babysitter, but the rest of the day, like, both of us want to work and you can't work all the time, right? So how do you split the time that you work versus the time that you are responsible for the kids, et cetera? We literally have it all calendared and it is equal to the minute.
Should other people do the same thing?
Probably not. I mean, I think most people don't want to be in an equal relationship. Maybe the vast majority of people.
Yeah.
So it's really not for everybody. But a lot of people imagine themselves to want to be in an equal relationship and then become surprised when suddenly they realize that they actually want something else. So the stated preference is very, I would say, attractive to embrace. Oh, equality is so great. Oh, it's a value. It's somebody who will understand me on every different level. You know what I mean? I can engage with them like this and like that. And it's like what Esther Perel talks about like the person who I'm with needs to be somebody I can talk about work with and also have great sex with and also, you know, understand my childhood and this and that, right? And have my same taste in movies and food or whatever it is. And so I feel like you really have to have a very high degree of similarity and compatibility to have what we have. And a lot of people don't have that or don't necessarily want that. So what they need is, for example, somebody nurturing on the other side of the relationship because they want to be gung-ho about this or that. And there's somebody out there who wants to be more nurturing. That's totally fine. And, you know, and so I feel like the kind of equality-oriented world that we're in, where everybody is an individual, everybody needs to self-actualize, et cetera, drives people to embrace this kind of stated preference and maybe even pursue in their actions some sort of equality, which they don't really want.
Do you guys basically have the same dynamic since when you started? Like, have you guys changed a lot since you started dating, or the dynamic changed, or have you guys always just been very similar? How do you think about your own sort of similarities or differences?
I think a lot changed when we had kids. We just have a new set of responsibilities as parents that needed to be defined.
Okay.
Yeah. So there's less time, right? Like there's work, there's the career aspect. We want to be with our kids. We also have our family and friends, and we're both extremely ambitious, but there's less time when you have kids. And so we have had to become more meticulous in
sure.
planning out the calendar. So we not only have time for ourselves, for our date nights, but also, you know, we had to do things like create solo sabbaticals. So lived sure. last year, we kind of experimented every year and expanded on it. So now every year, each of us gets five day breaks that we call sabbaticals. So a total of 15 days a year where we can just go do whatever we want on our own.
It's like paid leave.
Yeah. And the other, you know, one of us stays with the kids or manages the childcare and make sure everything kind of continues to run. And we love giving this to each other because, you know, people love to define married couples as like married. And then sometimes people like merge and you just kind of become this inseparable thing. And no, it's not true. Like Adam is Adam and I'm me, and we want to keep it that way, you know? And so that time and how we use it allows us to stay kind of honest to like who we are as individuals. So we had to create that structure, I think, to maintain our independence while we create our life together.
Yeah. Yeah. I agree with that. It feels more, let's say, tactical to maintain those kind of things that in our previous circumstances would come more naturally because we'd hang out with different friends all the time and we'd bring back those kind of experiences to the relationship and so forth. But when you're with kids and you have, you know, more structure and so forth and increasing responsibilities, it's very easy to get stuck, you could say, and just be less dynamic. You're just doing the same stuff over and over again. You're spending all your time with one another because it's just easier. And you tell yourself a story, or you could, that like, oh, I'm such a great family person because I'm with a family all the time, or I'm with the kids all the time. But life is not just family or just being together. It's also exploring other experiences.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, I think we both really enjoy the wonders and kind of being adventurous. And I think a concern a lot of people have with getting married or like having kids is like you get boring and life becomes really mundane. And I think...
And a lot of people do get boring. Let's be real. If you're one of those people listening to this podcast, I mean, you might want to consider a change.
Yes. It's like, how do we keep life adventurous?
Yeah. And spicy.
And pursue our curiosities and also allow our kids to, you know, pursue their curiosities. So now it's like four individuals that we have to like brainstorm and we treat each of our kids as, you know, as true individuals, although they still need guidance. So now like, yeah, with marriage, it was between us and now it's like four.
Yeah.
So it just gets more complex with time, but it's fine, you know, and it allows us to rethink about our values and what do we want to protect and what are things we want to like take risks on.
Yeah.
And it's fun.
Yeah, there's kind of no choice, right? Yeah. Because the time and the time compresses, you really need to be more deliberate about carving out things so that they happen.
Say more about what you think other couples can learn from behaviors that you've adopted to elevate your bond or your day-to-day with kids or just in general, if people were to have, watched you over the years, what they could learn from in terms of what you guys learned.
Sure. Yeah. The weird tricks that we discovered. All right. You want to start?
A quick one that I really like, as kind of like the mother role is, so each one of our kids has their own Google calendar, and every wake hour that they have, it's clear who the lead owner of the child is. So whether it's Adam, me, it might be an au pair, a babysitter, a tutor, school, but there's clarity around it. And we plan that ahead to make sure it's, satisfying for the kids. And we also measure our independent hours, not just with both kids, but like with our older child who's 7, we want to have like dates with her too. So we plan that calendar out ahead of time. And that's just been a really great hack because it sounds really annoying and meticulous, but like it's not like we're looking at the calendar all the time. It's just such a relief when you're at home and like the kids are running around, but I'm not the one leading right now. So I can actually do what I want, but also enjoy time with family, knowing that Adam is in charge of diaper change right now. And that like freedom is very refreshing. And I think a lot of mothers constantly feel that they're the lead for their babies and their kids. And so some kind of structure like that can give more kind of time for themselves as they're raising young kids, I think is really helpful for the mind, Yeah.
So what about you? Well, we try to have dinner together as a family every day. And we say what we're grateful for. And we discuss that. So that's like a really, I think, a good and healthy practice. We try to meditate, although we haven't been able to do it as regularly as we'd like. As a family, starting with very low commitment, like a minute, because, we have a 7-year-old. So like sometimes it's just like a few minutes or whatever it is. That's good. And then once a year, we do a life board of directors. So we also do a kind of a planning session for the year. And sometimes we do weeklies. We have weekly one-on-ones where we evaluate our progress as a team and also evaluate what's going on with like the kids. So like kind of a regular meeting just to evaluate and track, et cetera. But what other hacks do we have?
Yeah, I think, it sounds like we have all these meetings, but I feel like at the core, we just kind of, there's a sense of trust in each other.
Yeah.
That we don't really have to be like on top of each other. Like it's hard to describe.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's also, one thing that works really well is just if something is bothering you, you want to bring it up in a time of low tension. You know what I mean? And so we have this notion of airing of grievances. And so we very intentionally call it that because it's like it positions you. So when we do like certain reviews, and this is true like with our kids and with like the au pair or whatever, I think framing it like that gives people permission. It's almost like a pressure, like tell us your grievances. This is that moment. Even though there aren't many, there are certain hacks like that that we found useful.
Yeah. And Emma, I think Adam has used the airing of grievances to share very micro things on how I can be a better partner. For example, he would say like, Presh, do you know how many times I've brought you, a cup of chamomile tea or like the casual lunch when I make some for myself, I bring it to you. Have you done that for me? And I would just feel horrible. But it's not contentious. Like it's almost like, oh my God, like you're right. Like I need to learn how to be a better human. So that's been nice. I think also Adam just does you're really good at like de-escalating high tension conversations. So if I'm emotional about something and I'm like sharing it with Adam, he would really just stay calm, and even if what I'm saying doesn't make any sense, he would know enough not to just make a logical like response on the moment, you know? And so yeah, he just knows how to de-escalate that and then bring it up later when I'm feeling better. So I guess we just kind of learn, maybe that's how you've always been, but.
No, I think we've learned each other's patterns more.
Yeah. I think one thing you've also, that I'm really careful of is if Adam is in a kind of like low mood or down mood, I would get impacted and I would also feel negative.
Mm-hmm.
And what Adam has shared is actually like when he's negative, like it's actually preferable that I stay cheery and I can like lift him up. And it's like, that's really difficult to do, but I'm working on that, you know? And so these are just small things that we work on. So every moment, we're just trying to be the best version of ourselves to each other.
Yeah, I think those are really good examples. Mm-hmm. There's also like some cross-cultural things. So for example, you know, I am looser with time. Okay, so I might be late. And, you know, and I don't mean to be offensive, you know what I mean? But like Israeli culture is more tolerant of that. And of course, that's changed. Like to most Israelis nowadays, I would seem like the most pedantic, like crazy person Israeli. Whereas to Japanese people, I would be like kind of like middle of the pack. He's okay, maybe. Sometimes he slips. But you know, with Rhea, I think that she would be more like, you know, hurt if I were late to things, or just like not really hurt, but it would create tension. You know what I mean? Because Japanese, you always want to be on time, et cetera. And then she would chew me out for it. You know what I mean? Now, the irony is, of course, like this is a case where I was in the wrong, right? So I'm not justifying that at all. That being said, at the same time, it's like when she's late, I will say, well, I never give you a hard time when you're late. You know what I mean? Because I don't care about it. And so like, that's just like one example where knowing each other, knowing what we're sensitive to and how to know when to be careful and when to just be more tolerant, I think have been learnings. And there are a few dimensions like that, yeah. Right?
Mm-hmm. That's really interesting. Adam, the sort of, you doing a lot of the sort of, you know, you're splitting it 50-50. If most men were given the option of doing that versus having someone else do most of it, I you know, suspect most people would prefer or choose to have other people doing it. What's sort of the case for why men should reconsider doing more of that? Or like, and what are the trade-offs there?
I don't think there's a case really. I don't think there's a case to be made, actually. I think that people should just know themselves and understand their preferences and find the golden ratio.
And so that's something, why are you like that? It's not obvious to me that you would be like that. Have you always been like it?
Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, so there are a few levels to that answer. One level is to say, well, I grew up, and maybe this is like some biological predilection, with a strong sense of like fairness and equality as like fundamental values. Those are some of my most fundamental values. I really can't stand the idea of somebody being condescending or like not speaking to other people in a down-to-earth manner. And so that, to me, that ties into this notion of fairness. You know what I mean? So that's really deeply ingrained in me. And so I feel like if there's something that I don't really want to do, I will assume that that other person who I love maybe also doesn't want to do it that much, right? And if that's true, it's just as if I like took their half of the cookie, and that's not fair. And so I just really revolt against that. So there's something about it that, which has nothing to do with like being in a marriage or being male or female. It's just something very fundamental to like, if you're two humans, you should be fair to one another. And so being sensitive to that, I think, is one factor. You know, I grew up in a house where both my parents worked. And I think in general, I grew up with a very strong education around fairness being a core value. And then beyond that, I looked for somebody who wanted to be an equal. So I felt that life is going to be much more fun as a full-on special forces team, as an A team. And so if you're on an A team, yeah, sure, people have different strengths, et cetera, but everybody, you know, carries the heavy backpacks everybody cleans the toilets, everybody does everything. You know what I mean? And so I think about a marriage more like being with a co-founder. And so if you're going to be with a co-founder, it's not that you're not different, but you do need to be equally load-bearing in some key ways. And because we happened to look for somebody who was more similar to us. And I think that's also because I'm more of a absolute type person. So I want to share everything. And that's part of the reason that I was looking for somebody who overlapped with me on a lot of factors. And so if you combine those aspects, right, you overlap in many ways. You have a very strong sense of fairness and equality as a fundamental human construct and value. And you don't really care for any constructs like gender or anything like that. And you want to kick ass and just do great things. You know, the operational stuff, like neither of us want to cook, we just hire somebody. You know what I'm saying? Like you solve them with money or with logistics. You don't solve them by saying, hey, I just, you know, don't feel like doing more of this because I blah, and you should do more of it. Did you have that sense growing up? Of like fairness and equality?
No, actually, to be honest, I was so surprised that Adam was actually true 50-50, because I think I've seen many of my female friends and just, you know, women who are older than me always talk about how even if you think you're going into a 50-50 relationship, in reality, women kind of take on like 80%, 90% of household kind of responsibilities and childcare. And so I was quite shocked, actually, when Adam was just like, of course it's 50-50, you know, and it was refreshing. And yeah, it's like you were born this way. Like, it's not like he's trying to follow some kind of like feminist philosophy or anything. Like, it's just how he sees the world. And I guess I lucked out. But on my end, I think what's so important, I think, in our marriage is we're both extremely independent, actually. Like, you know, one of us can just like leave and we would be fine. You know, we would take care of the kids, you know, take care of the household duties, families, continue on with our career.
You're both full stack parent.
Yeah. But like life is actually funner when we're together and we can like make on the fly decisions based on that moment, being like, oh, well, you take this on, I take this on, because you really need to like nail this, you know, this negotiation this week, you know, let me take this. And we can have that live conversation because we're kind of in it together, but we're so independent. And so it's almost like we don't even have to be married, but we are married.
Marriage.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yes. Right? I mean, maybe.
I feel that way. I totally agree. And I mean, we weren't even planning to get married.
Yeah.
We were like, why get married in the first place? But then we thought about it. Well, I mean, I wear an Aura ring now. So does she. But yeah, anyway. So like, basically we did it for the sleep score. That's why we did it.
Why did you do it?
Because we thought like, what is a marriage? It's a statement about community. You don't need to tell it to each other. You're telling it to the world. In your heart, you know your commitment to one another, et cetera. You don't need the recognition of the government, even though that might be like a practical thing that may have utility. So there's like the getting married on paper, and that may have its own logic. And it did have a logic, you know what I mean? Like at the end of the day, she needed a green card. I'm just kidding.
And she needed an angel investment.
But we thought that, okay, like if we make this statement, and we bring people together to a wedding, we're kind of saying, hey, we want to be in a community with you. And we are representing ourselves as a kind of unit towards you. And we thought there's some value in that.
Some value.
Yeah, man, let's not overdo it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Can you share how you guys think about monogamy? And I do feel compelled to say that this is a question you suggested I ask, because I'm not a creep or anything.
I mean, yeah, right. Jury's out. But who asked that? Was it me or you? But anyway, who knows? I mean, it's all haze right now. Monogamy. I mean, you know, I just feel like it's not been very much of a strong motivation for us to even consider whether being non-monogamous is important. I think we're like, our attitude has always been, and correct me if you feel differently, but that you know, if it becomes an issue, we'll just discuss it and we can be open-minded about it. But so far, it's not been really like a pursuit or a consideration.
That's such a white issue. Isn't such a normal answer.
Yeah, I mean, we're really quite plain vanilla.
Boring.
Extremely boring.
Well, when you suggested the question, I thought you maybe had, you know.
I was expecting something.
Well, I'm sorry. I have to say, I have to contradict that. And I'll say that, like, in the current world of polyamory and, you know, you have to have this or that open relationship, or you have to have a few weddings and other kids and whatever. I mean, just, you know, this is an act of rebellion. Really?
Yeah, exactly. You know, one thing that the listener may not know is that Adam sort of, you know, is dedicating his life to living forever and, you know, pursuit of helping the longevity field move forward so that more people can live forever. Whereas Rie is supportive of that ambition, but maybe doesn't share it to the same degree. And it seems more like a normal person in that respect. Rie, what is that like? How do you guys manage that?
What is it like? I mean, Adam's always been a big dreamer. I think we connect because we're just like dreamers. And we like to think big. So I don't think it's anything new. Like, it's just how he's always been. Now he's actually, you know, spending more of his time on it. But I don't think Adam has changed from when I met him. In terms of how I deal with it as the partner, so it's fascinating. I feel like I'm a vitalist too. Like, I'm totally, you know, just getting sucked into and learning more about, you know, what's going on in the longevity space, and it's really exciting. And we often joke about how, you know, Adam tries to recruit me fully into longevity, and I'd be like, well, no, let's not do that again. Like, let's keep our separate courses so that our life stays interesting.
Because of what happened last time we worked together.
Yeah. And it's just like funner to have like more different experiences, right? Like, we don't want to merge into one human, right? Like,
TBD.
TBD.
Could happen. See what happened with, you know, the singularity, but.
Yeah. But what was I going to say? So, but in terms of how we think about like our worth, right? Like, so if, you know, we talked about it, right? Like, if Adam is just like gung-ho gonna pursue the longevity, like as a life mission, and for us, like, you know, our financial asset together, I'm totally happy besides, or, you know, what we need for a daily spend, that like 90%, 95% of the rest of our net worth goes into the cause of longevity. And I shared that with him immediately, unless I come up with an equally relevantly passionate life mission of mine, then we would have to renegotiate the way we would distribute our assets. But I felt like, yeah, we're all in people. So we're kind of in it together. And even if my time is not fully dedicated, our, you know, the way we think about how we deploy our assets is pretty much aligned. So does that answer your question?
Sure. It segues to another question, which is, do you want to share more about how money and resource decisions matter in relationships and how you guys think about that?
Well, before we do, I wanted to just add something, if you don't mind, a little bit of spice to that already very tasty stew, which is that I think Rie has really come around to longevity with aging.
Eric keeps telling us we're so old, you know? Yeah. Totally.
You know, she basically has already forgotten her protests from before. You know, dementia was the solution. No, just kidding. But you know, one time we were in Israel and we were having dinner, and she was just telling me, wow, all those people who are just like giving up and are just going to like get old and die, and they're just not trying to do anything about it. That's so boring. And I said, exactly. Yes, you get it.
Yeah.
And then, you know, nowadays she's like, you know, I mean, we have two young kids and, you know, people are getting older and like friends of ours are getting like Botox and stuff like that. And it's like, aging sucks. It's like, we should do something about this. You know? So it's becoming an easier sell, I have to say.
Okay, money.
Oh yeah, money. When we started dating, we had like one mutual account and separate accounts as well. So we have like a distribution of capital where, you know, we handle the investments collaboratively, but then we have like some funds that are slotted off independently where we don't know what's happening with them. Could be anything. I mean, she could be in like the Melania meme coin and lost everything. I would know.
No one knows.
No one knows. She may not even know. It's our money manager in Brunei.
But in terms of, I think that's not, well, yeah. Let's add more.
Yeah, let's add more spice to this. Yeah.
So I think like what does make our life easier is that we have a pretty similar view of money and how we spend it.
Yeah.
So we learned this over the time, looking at how our friends and like, you know, people spend their money differently.
Or prioritize money as a factor in their life.
Yeah.
That's not us. We're actually almost anti-materialistic. We don't care for assets or money, really. We just acquire it because like it's useful.
And I think even from when we were dating, so this is really interesting because when you're like dating somebody, it's like, what's their, like, how do they use money, right? Like, are they going to pay for this dinner? You know, if we go on a trip together, are we like splitting even or is he going to take it? So I think we felt very much aligned that he felt like I'm not, how do you call it?
What?
High maintenance, because I was okay in this like dirty outfit going to a date. But I think I kind of assessed his way of spending as he can spend a lot on luxury experiences and he can also go really low. Like he can, you know, just be in a tent, you know, or like live in a hostel. And I love that variety because for me, you know, I wanted someone who I could adventure the world with and not be limited to like certain kind of criterias, you know, or kind of like, I didn't want to be in any circle that's like a money kind of status game, but more about enriching our lives through experience. And I felt like the way you spend money and the way I spend money is pretty hard.
I agree with that.
Right? Like we have a pretty diverse way we spend.
Yeah.
And in general, like if we do have more money, we end up spending it on similar things. Like we reinvest it into like startups or companies or, you know, like it's less material things.
Well, it's not, and it's not only that, it's that we have a similar perspective on risk with money.
Yeah.
So in fact, I would say to some degree, it's a liability. It's a strength and a liability. The thing is that like, we are very risk loving. So if one of us says, you know, I'm thinking about doubling down on this angel investment, typically, the other one would always say, why not triple down? You know what I mean? Why not quadruple down? And of course, that's not always the right decision. And so, you know, we learned, I think, that it's useful for us to play devil's advocate towards one another, because in some ways, we're often pointing in the same direction with money. And that's not always a great strategy if you want to like hedge or diversify, et cetera, et cetera. But it can be too, right? Because concentrated bets do give you outsized returns. So, I mean, we're just very aligned that way.
What more can you share about your parenting philosophy or values or what you hope for your kids? What you think other people can learn from? Yeah.
Well, we try to provide our kids with an environment where they can be really independent on as many levels as possible from early on. And we try to be systematic about educating ourselves and mapping areas that are developmentally appropriate so that they can, you know, engage at the right level. What else?
Well, we introduce a ton of change into their lives. You know, we basically roamed around the world with both of our kids. So they, you know, they've been exposed to living in 5 different languages in different cultures and learning how to connect to people with completely different values and religions. We'd wish for them to be able to connect with as many humans as possible. And so that's just from our lifestyle. We encourage that.
But also at times spent together. So we have a strong bias for the kids to be around us as much as possible. So now it's not always, you know, without trade-offs, because if we want to work and they have needs, they may not allow us to work, but we're generally big fans of like the kids having a full-time tutor and being with us at home until at least they're like 4 or 5. And then even later on, we have some inclination towards homeschooling of one variant or another, because we feel like, you know, we have precious little time with our kids and there's a lot we want to share with them. And we know them probably better than any teacher in a kind of mainline school would be able to know them. And so I'm not saying that there isn't room for specialized instruction. And of course, there are tutors and different ways to do things. But we think that being around our kids a lot and integrating them organically into everything we do, from talking about the business to politics to family perspectives, money, values, is something that's a priority. You know, being fully transparent.
Does that make sense? Just want to raise a flag that for anybody in the Bay Area who's interested in setting up a homeschooling pod for their kid or kids ages 6 through 9, we're looking for people to set something up with. And you can find us on Twitter at Adam Grease or at Rhea Globe or on LinkedIn. Please reach out and DM and let's see if we can do something together. Given that we have limited time, so I want to paint some broad questions and let you go wherever you think is most interesting. So one would be, if you knew what you know now, what might you tell yourself about relationships, whether it's a couple of years ago, 5 years ago, 10 years ago, that you think we haven't discussed yet? Or more broadly, is there something else that comes to mind that we haven't discussed yet pertaining to some of these topics that you think would be good to share?
I mean, one thing I would say is that you need to be brave to tolerate emotional pain, which is a type of pain that a lot of people have low tolerance for. And it's the kind that you have to tolerate if you want to get into the relationship that is a preferred relationship. So, you know, I feel like I was in relationships that lasted too long, which I didn't cut off early enough, or I made compromises that were the wrong kind of compromises because I wasn't ready to break things off, etc. And that delayed me getting into the relationship with Rhi. And so, I mean, we met when we were around 30, so it wasn't like that late. But if I went back in time and told myself something before we met, it would be that. Just be more tolerant of emotional pain and acknowledge the reality of it, that SUP is going to feel painful and that is a necessary part of the process. And if you prepare your expectation for that, you may be more ready for it. And I think most people don't want to look that in the eye. So then they encounter the impending pain when it's just around the corner. And then they're like, oh shit, like this looks horrible. So they don't pull triggers when they should pull triggers. That's one big one. If I went way back, what about you?
No, I don't think I have any advice for other people. It's such a different experience for everybody, you know, and I don't think everyone should get married. But life is more enriching if you can find a life partner. And how to go about that? I don't know. I think it's a numbers game. Just like go out there, you know, and like meet as many people. Like we lucked out, but I don't think I was very strategic about it. You know, I luckily, I guess one thing is like when you're pursuing something you really like and you meet people in that sphere, there's naturally going to be more things that are aligned, right? Like because I was a startup founder and he was a startup founder, like our circles were so similar and our interests. And so that just made it an immediate win. So if you're trying to look for your life partner, just being more honest with what you want to do with your life. Like if you, as a single person, what do you want to be spending your time on? Just focusing on that and then meeting people in that space is probably the only thing I would do.
Yeah.
Like if I were single right now.
Yeah. I mean, I also feel like there is sort of something that maybe I would tell myself and I'd probably tell others too. There is an illusion of the level of difficulty around finding a great match. And I think a lot of people radically underestimate how difficult it is. So to give an example, which is comparable, let's imagine you're a founder and you grew up in a place where there were no other founders. And so you don't know, like, great entrepreneurs, you don't know what that looks like. You don't know what a co-founder, a good co-founder might be. I think that a lot of people would say, oh yeah, like, it is plausible that you would need to search for like years and years. You may never find like Steve Wozniak or Steve Jobs. Like, it actually doesn't happen that often. Maybe it happens once in a billion years, once and a billion people, sorry. Maybe it won't happen for you, period. And so I feel like what most people do is they have a misunderstanding of how difficult it is. And as a result of that, that's upstream of those decisions of saying, oh, maybe I just need to work harder. Because what happened is there is a better match out there. But it is.
So you effectively do believe in a one.
No, not a one. But I just think that the really great relationships are rare. I mean, the great matches.
So, I mean, if it's one in a billion, it might as well be a one, right?
Yeah, but I think it's probably not one in a billion. So it's, you know, on some smooth distribution, right? But if you want a 2-standard deviation or a 3-standard deviation level match, well, guess what? That's like the probability set. And ask yourself, am I going out there enough? Am I meeting enough people? Am I exploring? Am I going deep fast enough to really evaluate somebody quickly and so forth? And I think most people don't. And so they actually have a confusion. They go for a limited pool, and then they assess within that limited pool, and then they justify their choices post hoc, which is unfortunate. And so I would say maybe as also kind of one tip that we learned, I think, over time, also to identify friends and so forth, it's really useful to be in environments where you can see a lot of people interacting with other people in a short amount of time. So if you have like an event with like 30, 40 people, and you can see people like raising their hands and speaking and interacting with others, I feel like that's a real shortcut to get a sense of their disposition. And you get that in high school and college. But after those circumstances, you don't get that as much. You don't get that at work. It's the same people all the time, et cetera, et cetera.
I guess, like, you know, just similar commentary, but changing location, right? Like, Adam changed location. He came to New York to look for his wife. Like, I changed locations multiple times. And we do that not just for relationships, but, like, you know, even as a family, like, we roamed around the world looking for where should we make our home bases, right? And where can we find the best community and friends? Where is the best place to start a company so we can be surrounded by inspiring people? We had like spreadsheets analyzing this stuff. It's move, and we live there and we like experience it, right? Like, so we're making the moves to find people we want to hang out with, people who we want in our community. And I think, like, with dating, like, you got to get out of wherever you are, change location, change venue if you're not finding your what.
And in addition, just to expand upon that, just think about human relationships, right? So now you want to have a 3-sigma partner, and you want to have a 3-sigma friend, and you want to have a 3-sigma couple friends.
Oh my goodness.
Where they're also 3-sigma partners to one another. The probabilities get low fast. Okay. So you reach a point where you acknowledge this idea of the actual natural laws here, and you realize, like, all right, so shit, like, yeah, you know, we have this fun one friend, like, you know, she's okay, but, you know, she's not that great, but she's like a 1-sigma friend, but we want to get a 3-sigma friend, but we know that's really insanely difficult. So at some point in life, you do make some compromises, you know? Now, that doesn't mean you don't like the people you're around or whatever. So I don't think we're like perfectionists. We acknowledge that, like, you can't have the best ultimate of everything. But it's also important to understand, like, if you want that, what the cost is.
I just was reminded of the, you know, my business idea that were partners.
Yeah, go ahead.
I thought it was such a genius idea because we were constantly feeling like it's so hard to meet other like-minded couples. And we would also hear other couples being like, it's so hard to meet other couples we could hang out with. And so, you know, I naively thought, oh, this is going to be my new business. You know, let me like create this like partners matching, you know, something that just works and makes everyone happy. And, you know, the feedback I got was like horrible, horrible business. Like, first of all, each couple has so much work to do with themselves. There's like no room to be doing matching among couples. And so I had to get that up.
And then, you know, if they have kids, it's like, the one waste in the quarter that they have any time, they want to spend it with you? Yeah. Are you kidding me? Yeah. I mean, the risk of failure is catastrophic. So, and then you think about it, it's like, but this is a big problem, you know, with couples in general, right? Like, if you meet an individual, a single person, and they join a couple, I mean, let's be real, it can get weird, right? Because it's like, you're the couple, oopy schmoopy, you know, and the individual is like, what's going on here? You know, and it's like, and they have different concerns because they're like, how do I find my three sigma mate? And you're just like, how do I get to sleep another hour at night with my two-year-old? You know what I mean? Like, concerns really start varying. And then you're like, well, maybe I should just have like couple friends. But then you're back to square one, because it's like, you're looking, it's hard enough to find one person you like, right? It took 10 years. Now you're looking for a person who you both like, who is with another person who all three of you like. Oh my God, are you kidding me? So then you go out with this couple, and it's like, it's always that one of the members of the couple is just like boring or annoying. Maybe that's one of us to them. You know what I mean? Like, it's just insanely hard. It's a really hard problem. And it feels like, it's almost like, yeah, the more, you know, reps you put in to meet couples, the higher the odds. But we're talking about like a galactic lottery. Like, you know, does it matter if it's one in a trillion or five in a trillion?
No, positive. You know?
Okay, so it's the note we're ending on is your match is one in a billion and couple's friend is one in a trillion. So just, okay, get out there, guys.
Play the lottery. It's a numbers game. No, but you're still climbing up the distribution, right? You just need to acknowledge that, like, you may have made, you know, a one sigma. You're in one sigma territory, and you might make it to one and a half sigma, but you're not making it farther.
Right.
One way you can amplify your chances of finding a good match is reach. And I'm really grateful for you, Eric, giving us this platform. And I want to make a call. If you are a couple who thinks you may be a three sigma couple fit for us, our DMs are open.
The kids in the background, absolutely perfect. We'll have your Twitter handles in the show notes, and yeah, do reach out. I can confirm that the Adam and Ria are in fact three sigma couple.
Thank you, guys.
Thanks for listening to Modern Relationships. Please make sure you're following on Apple, Spotify, or YouTube. If you have a chance, leave us a review or comment on this episode to let me know who else you'd like to hear from on this show. Modern Relationships is a podcast from Turpentine, the network behind Econ 102, Upstream, and Turpentine VC.